Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Racial tension and violence across the South during the 1950s was common. Today, we'll hear what happened in a little coal town in West Virginia where a different story emerged.
And of course, we knew each other because we played together with each other in the coal camps.
And so from that time on, in the sports world, in the school, in football and basketball, the track, we were one and the same.
But things went a bit differently for the African-American girls who wanted to be on the Mount Hope cheerleading squad.
We were told they had selected the cheerleaders before the school term started, and I was not a cheerleader at all when it became Mount Hope High School. That was something very dear and important to me, and I was very hurt.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, we're going to hear one of the stories that emerged in coal country during school integration in the 1950s. This episode is set in Mount Hope, West Virginia, a coal camp town in Fayette County. If you've never been there, picture in your mind a small, quaint downtown made up of stone and brick buildings. Like many Appalachian towns, there are rolling hills on either side. Two churches sit along the main street, and there are a couple of restaurants and a local hardware store there today. Nearly 50 years ago, the town was a bustling community. Most people worked in the coal mines or had family who did. Across the nation in those days, racial tensions were high as communities wrestled with desegregation, especially the South. In 1954, the Supreme Court ruled that racial segregation in public schools was against the law. The landmark Brown v. Board of Education overturned the separate but equal doctrine that underpinned legal segregation. In the years that followed, tensions and violence intensified, due in part to how public institutions implemented the Supreme Court's decision. There were shootings, bombings, and in 1957, President Eisenhower called in the National Guard to Little Rock, Arkansas to escort 9 black students into school to enforce integration. There were incidents of unrest across Appalachia, too. During the 1958-59 school year, there was a school bombing outside Morgantown, West Virginia, and there were protests in McDowell County where people held signs that said, "We support Little Rock." But some communities had a more peaceful experience, and so today we're going to focus on one of the stories that emerged in the little town of Mount Hope. By the way, one remarkable part of this community's story was that, unlike most communities across the country, the town of Mount Hope actually moved the white kids into the African-American school, W.E.B. Du Bois High School. African-American teachers continued to teach there, although some lost their jobs and were replaced by white teachers. They also changed the name to Mount Hope High School. In 1959, a few years after the two high schools consolidated, Mount Hope's integrated football team, the Mustangs, won the state championship. And they won the state title the next year, too.
Athletics bridges economic differences. It bridges ethnic and racial differences because people come together for one common purpose.
That's Kenneth Fleming, whose mother was one of the African-American teachers at Mount Hope High School during these years. Kenneth was interviewed as part of a new oral history project that explores the layers of history during the integration in Mount Hope. Let's listen to the first part of this story produced by Michael and Carrie Klein. Michael Klein is the first voice you'll hear.
In such a layered setting, peaceable school integration happened without taunting crowds, police escorts, and burning crosses, though crosses were burned on other occasions. Neighborhoods in town butted up against one another, and children found and shared close interracial friendships outside of school in the shadow of lingering discrimination.
Mr. Jackson, who was Jerry's grandfather, they always included me into their fishing trips and camping trips that they went on because I had never been on a camping trip and stayed overnight. And right down from the church, as you're going out to Holler, was the elementary school that I went to, which was called the Du Bois Elementary School.
Charles McKinney.
And, of course, there was no whites in that school. It was all black. And then you went from the primer, then the first, through the sixth grade. And then from the sixth grade, we would go uptown to the junior high school into the seventh grade. It had been integrated. It was black and white there in the junior high school.
They knew the black teachers when they got up there, so that helped.
Rose Payne was grateful for the black teachers who provided a measure of continuity for African-American students, first in the integrated middle school and later in the high school.
We had black teachers mixed when we got to the high school also, so it wasn't like we were separated and thrown into an all-white school.
But on the other side of the junior high school, there also was an elementary school, which was a white school.
Charles McKinney.
That's where most of the white kids went, and you had a few of the black kids that went to the elementary school where the white kids went.
But we all learned to get along, and the football team, we played in it, we had band and everything. That's one thing about Mount Hope, we all got along at school.
I actually got into high school band in the eighth grade. I was a trumpet player. You know, that was quite a challenge. I was the littlest guy in the band. I was tiny.
Scott Vargo, class of 1966, was an outstanding Oak Hill educator in his professional life.
That was a great experience for me. Nathan Shelton brought a guitar on the bus just about every trip. Awesome guy. Wrote a lot of his own music and great singer. And we sang all the way to football games and all the way back home from football games.
When the stars we look upon to tumble and fall, all the mountains should crumble to the sea. No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Not alone as you stand. Stand by me.
He added a lot of perk. He played a bass horn in the band.
Yeah, well, the band experience in high school was my best lived experiences.
Nathan Shelton.
I got to travel, you know, because we went to all the football games. When I went to audition for the band at the beginning of the school year, it was the 10th grade, I wanted to play the saxophone. And unbeknownst to me, the school did not supply a saxophone. So the band director said, well, if you don't have your own horn, say, I need a tuba, please. I said, I'll take it. Tuba was bigger than me. Okay. But I just wanted in that band so bad. If you look at the 65, 66 yearbook, you'll see the tuba. And under that tuba is me. Okay.
My mother would not allow me to play football because I had work to do at home.
Charles McKinney.
I had to feed the chickens. I had to, you know, slop the hogs. My chores took up a lot of my time after school, and she wouldn't allow me to play football. But when we did get a chance to play, like on Saturdays, we would all meet up at the football field, and we played football. And we would play there until the people came and they would run us off the field, told us that we're not supposed to be here. You know, we were all black, climbed the fence over on the football field, and somebody would call the cops and say some black boys up there playing on the football field. And the cops would come and run us off the football field.
Foreigners were discriminated against in the United States, a lot like the black people were discriminated against.
Brenda Troitino.
And in the coal camps in this area, white people lived in one section, the foreign people lived in another section, and the black people lived in a third section. Mount Hope and Fayette County is comprised of a lot of people who came from other parts of the world.
Brenda Vargo.
My dad was a Kennedy, and he was English. Johnny Bull is what he used to say. That's what they used to call him. And mother was a Dago, a WOP, Italian, because that's the vernacular they used.
Brenda Troitino.
My heritage is Spanish and Italian. My mother's parents immigrated from Italy, and my father came to the United States on December the 7th, 1941, as Pearl Harbor was being bombed. He had just escaped fascism. His family lived in the northwestern part of Spain, and as a young man, he worked in a stone shop in Madrid. which was quite a distance from his home. And that's when the revolution broke out in Spain. And he fought against Franco. When the war was over, he had to make his own way to come to the United States. So I think that a lot of the people from this area learned that the only way you're going to survive is for everybody to work together.
There was no line of demarcation in the coal mines. When everybody came out of the mines anyway, they were all black.
Generations that came here from Europe had seen discrimination when they got here because they weren't actual quote-unquote Americans that came over here with pilgrims. That's why this area didn't see a lot of problems as far as blacks and whites living and working together.
I'll never forget Jerry Adams and myself, along with Mickey Plumley, who was white, and David Rhodes, who was white. We got together, and basically we grew up together.
Charles McKinney.
They went to the grade school, up where the grade school people went. I went to Du Bois, but after the evening was over with, we all would come home, and we would play together.
You know, a lot of my time was spent down in Kessler Hollow.
David Rhodes.
We played marbles. Baby Charles was always better than me. He would usually get my best marbles, you know. He would win them, and I'd try to win them back. And we spent a lot of time up in the woods and go for a walk up on the hill above the house. You know, if there was snow on the ground, you'd go sleigh riding. If it was warm, you played stickball, you played marbles. We were just kids having a good time.
Richard Eubanks didn't live long enough to tell his own story as a star black athlete, but many players, black and white, recall his pressing them to join the school sports teams.
Richard had came to me and says, I want you to go out for football.
Charles McKinney.
So I told him, I said, well, you know, my mom is not going to let me go out for football. So he says, I tell you what, you just tell her you're going to be a water boy for a couple of hours, you know. That's how long practice lasted, about a couple of hours. So I said, okay. So me and him went to my mother and told my mother that we're going to be water boys. And that's how I got on the football team.
Tom Brown.
Du Bois High School was the school for the black students for this whole area, from Fayetteville through Mount Hope.
Kathleen Scott.
I became a cheerleader at Du Bois. Seventh grade, I was on the varsity squad.
Kathleen Scott remembers the prowess of Du Bois middle and high school athletics, in which she was encouraged to participate.
That was because of Eunice Fleming, the cheerleader coach. She asked my parents, could I be a cheerleader? So I was the varsity cheerleader at seventh grade.
As I grew up, I realized Mount Hope had a black high school and a white high school, and they put them together. But it wasn't quite like that.
Tom Brown, class of 1973, now heads up the Mount Hope Heritage Center, a high school museum and community meeting place. Tom has a passion for local history, especially memories of the Mount Hope Mustangs. Built in 1917, the W.E.B. Du Bois High School exploded one night in 1950 and burned to the ground. The African-American students were housed in makeshift classrooms conducted in storefronts and church basements.
When I got there in 1953, we had to have classes in the church, storefront buildings, some temporary buildings, and so forth.
Betty Brown.
And we'd walk from class to class. The principal's office was in the basement of the church. And then we walked out the street and up to temporary buildings for other classes.
In 1954, the Fayette County School Board completed the brand new W.E.B. Du Bois High and opened to the joy of black students and faculty. And though the new school was empty of books or lab equipment, it had a modern cafeteria, sparkling restrooms, and big sunny windows. And it was theirs, at least temporarily.
We loved that new building. It was wonderful, state of the art. For its time, We had a nice library, but no books. I remember the English teacher taking us there one day, and all there was a set of encyclopedias and a large unabridged dictionary.
Jean Evans Moore and Kathleen Scott remember a visit from school board officials at the end of their sophomore year in June 1956 that suddenly changed everything.
Over the intercom system, the announcement was made that if you were in 10th grade, which is what I was in, you were to go to the cafeteria.
I went to the cafeteria. In comes a white man, E.W. Dunkley.
Kathleen Scott.
The first thing they said was, some of the students now, next year, they won't be coming here. Some will be going over to Oak Hill High School, which was just devastating. When they integrated the segregated schools, they took the Du Bois High School building, and that became Mount Hope High School.
If you live this place, you will go to this school, and it just went on and on.
I asked the question, what do you mean? What do you mean by integrated? They're going to let the white kids and the black kids go to school together. Some of my best friends and my boyfriend at that time, they would be going over to Oak Hill High School. They would not be with me anymore.
When we integrated, that was like the world just kind of came apart. Because all these people that you had known for years, people that you'd gone to school with, got sent to other places. You got sent to places that were closer to where you lived. So it was just devastating because to many of us, it was a total surprise.
Betty Brown.
We really didn't like it. We wanted to stay where we were. And we always said, they just want our new, brand new school. Because I tell you, when the school opened and they had open house, the whites were saying, oh, they're just going to tear this up. They're not going to take care of it. And of course, the next year, they integrate. They take our school, remove the name Du Bois High from it, and slap Mount Hope High on it. Mr. Smith had been on leave the year before, but he came back as a classroom teacher, which was wonderful because he was a brilliant man.
And I call it consolidation. People say the two schools were integrated. I call it they consolidated. And that building came about because Du Bois High School, it was destroyed by explosion and fire. The Board of Education knew they had to build a new building. And being aware that integration was coming, they built that building because they knew they were going to have to combine students. So it was top-of-the-line building at that time. Du Bois was no longer in existence. It became Mount Hope.
Black students struggled to come to terms with the losses. Here's Rose Payne again.
You start out one year, and the next year, four schools out, the school is integrated, and you're graduating from what you thought was going to be Du Bois, and you've got a Mount Hope High School certificate. You get a brand new school and then it's gone. Something to think about, you know. And then having to move and be shipped out of your area to go over to another school. Also, I mean, you're losing your culture, your black culture that you're used to. You get to learn more about your black history in a black school. And then now you don't get that. Once you're integrated, that's almost not even taught mostly.
Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, an illustrious educator for whom the school was named, spoke to these concerns when he said in 1958, quote, "The object of Negro education must be Negro culture, to let no part of our rich experience in this land be lost or die, to preserve our history and experience, our poetry, song, and rhythm, our biography and art, our ancient folkways. This is not an opposition to whites, rather in sympathy and fulfillment. We face the preservation and cultivation of Negro talent, not simply among our rich and well-to-do, but even more among the vast number of our poor and outcast, among those locked by the thousands in our jails and penitentiaries." This newly blended population of students reaching toward an understanding of integration and true equality had few models to draw from. The students, in large part, rose to this challenge and in many ways achieved cohesion in their bonding determination to watch each other's backs, as their fathers did every day with one another, despite ethnic and color differences in underground coal mines.
We've been listening to an excerpt of a documentary by Michael and Carrie Klein, featuring the voices of several people who lived in Mount Hope, West Virginia, when their high schools integrated in the 1950s. In a minute, we'll hear what this experience was like for cheerleaders, who had a different experience than the football players. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're going back to a time when schools across the nation were integrating. Some communities saw violence and protests, while others had a quieter, more peaceful experience as their schools merged. But even in Mount Hope, West Virginia, a place with fairly mild tensions between blacks and whites, there was some racism that divided the community. School administrators took their time integrating the cheerleading squad. In this next part of the story, we'll hear from several African-American cheerleaders, including Kathleen Scott.
I was a cheerleader until the integration of the schools. We were told they had selected the cheerleaders before the school term started, and I was not a cheerleader at all when it became Mount Hope High School. That was something very dear and important to me, and I was very hurt. We were not included. The football players and the basketball players, oh, they were included because Du Bois High School, they were always state champions and everything. They were able to participate.
Nathan Shelton.
It took a while for certain things to take place. Like they allowed blacks to play football, but you couldn't be a cheerleader or a majorette. There was no black cheerleaders or majorettes until my class, in fact, which is 8 years later. Two of the ladies in my class became cheerleaders. They had not been allowed. Certain things you weren't allowed to do. A friend of mine who went to Du Bois, she was telling me the story, man, and was crying. Because she said she wanted to be a cheerleader so bad, and they integrated the year that she went to high school. That was the year they integrated. And her heart was set on being a cheerleader, and they wouldn't let her because she was black. You know, certain things had to come later.
The most of the team was black.
Charles McKinney.
Even the track team, the basketball team. And you would wonder, well, why wasn't there a black majorette? Or why there wasn't a black cheerleader? And you wonder that. You know, some of us really didn't want to toss gasoline on a partially burning fire. But then you had others that was very outspoken, and they saw a need. And one of the guys, his name is Willie Ben Pritchett. He was one of the committee persons that went to the principal to find out why we didn't have a black cheerleader. And they went and they addressed this issue with the principal.
Willie Ben Pritchett.
I mean, guys in the football team, you know, we were not happy that we didn't have a black cheerleader. You know? I mean, we were not happy, you know, about that. They was having a little congregation here in front of the principal's office, which was Mr. Danner. He was the principal at the time. To talk to him about having a black cheerleader. He says, what I'm going to do, I'm going to let five of y'all come into my office, but I guarantee the five that walk in here would not graduate. And that's the way most things went down. They put the fear in you. So to stop you from standing up for yourself, they put fear in you. But then sometimes, you know, sometimes you got to take a stand. Well, I stepped forward, okay? I got a 3.68 GPA. You know, I'm on the football team, I'm on the track team and everything. When I'm in the glee club, stop me from graduating. So five of us stepped forward and went into his office. And his first statement was, "You people are like dogs. You pat them on the head and they'll lick you in the mouth every time." And that didn't go over with a couple of people in that group. Nobody swung any punches, but we had to hold one of them back to stop him from throwing punches. Got to discuss, and he said, "Well, we're going to talk to the band director at the time. They were going to get together and with the faculty, and they were going to try to find a black cheerleader." That was in 64, my senior year. You can't fight every battle. You got to pick your battles. Sometimes you know when wrong is wrong, and you say, "Okay, this one I got to fight."
Snapshot of the future, see it so clear. People still struggling, 'cause they live in fear. Let's take a thought.
And out of that meeting, we got our first black cheerleader. Her name was Sandra Williams.
Mr. Danner called me into the office and asked me if I wanted to be a cheerleader. And it sort of took me back because I'm saying, "Why me?" You know, like that. Because I was sure there was somebody else that could probably do a better job. That was my feeling at the time. Usually with cheerleading, you have to try out for it. And I didn't have to try out. I just became a cheerleader. In hindsight, I said, "I wonder why I was chosen. Was it because of the color of my skin and they wouldn't be able to tell if I was either white or black?" But they could still say that they had a black cheerleader at the time.
That was Sandra Williams, the first African-American cheerleader at Mount Hope High School. I was a cheerleader for 14 years and remain active as a coach. Cheerleading is the only activity that requires athletic ability to not only support other teams, but find the time and determination to develop individual skills. Cheerleaders today support football teams and often both men's and women's basketball teams. Cheerleaders encourage the players to believe in themselves. And this story of Mount Hope's cheerleaders was incredibly moving to me. To think that the football players were the ones to support and stand up for the cheerleaders and stand for what was right. When they had the power, they used it to help. I wonder if the white men in control even valued the support of any of the female cheerleaders, not to mention recognizing the importance of including everyone on the team, you know? Probably wasn't even on their radar. In a few minutes, we'll hear how integration went for the boys on the football team. One of the producers of this documentary was a football player himself at Mount Hope. His name is Jack Spadaro. And he told Inside Appalachia's Roxy Todd about why he wanted to help tell the story of his community's experience during desegregation.
How did your memories compare with what you were hearing from other people through this oral history project?
Well, you know, my memories were from the perspective of a young white person during that time. And when I began hearing the stories of my African-American friends who had played alongside me all those years, I found that the story was even richer than I remembered it. And also, I found that there were, even though by my account there were pretty much good times, there were sometimes still encounters by black students with the old ways of segregation. They still had to, into the mid-60s, had to endure segregated housing in the public housing areas. That didn't change until mid-60s, I think. Until, I think, the early 60s, the theaters were still segregated. The black kids had to go upstairs in a balcony. And another friend of mine reported and told me about this. Her name is Brenda Hyman, and she's going to be with us at a conference in Cincinnati in April. And Brenda said, "We talked recently about how much fun we all had together and our friendships, but she also pointed out to me that there was still a separation You know, we would all go to band practice or football practice or track practice or basketball practice together. But after that, there was still a separation in the communities, which was the leftover segregation from an earlier generation. So what I heard in the interviews about football just deepened my appreciation for what we were able to do as students and get beyond some of the barriers that had been set up before we were there.
And as far as what you decided to do, of course, you know, the media has done a lot of stories where outside journalists have come in, done a story, and left. But this is quite a different story. This is, you know, you worked with some oral historians, Michael and Carrie Klein, to collect long oral history interviews over a long period of time to get a really rich sense of the history and get a really rich sense of the story. Why did you choose to go about that method of doing the oral histories and, in a way, involving the community and telling their own story?
Well, I thought, well, there were two things. I wanted to get to the truth of the matter because I knew that because I was white, my perceptions would probably be a little rosier than my black classmates, okay? The other was I knew Michael and Carrie's work, and I knew that they have a really unique way of interviewing people where they don't really interject themselves that much into the conversation. And they let people tell their stories, and that reveals really so many layers that often have been forgotten or placed aside. And that's what we got. We have over 40 interviews that are so rich with all kinds of things that people remember and want to say now. And that has made this story far more meaningful even than I anticipated it to be, because it's shown, and it's especially in some of my friends like Charles McKinney, who is one of our leaders, and is the guy who started Mountain of Hope several years ago, this abundant love, it's remarkable. And this understanding, and what I didn't know, for instance, Charles's entire history, and I found out as a child he had played with three or four the white boys I grew up with, but he had started playing with them, I think, even before school. And he says in one of the interviews, and he's talking about how we played football together and how we protected each other, how each of us had a different area of the field we were responsible for. And he says toward the end of his interview, look, we loved each other, and that's the truth.
That was Jack Spadaro, who grew up in Mount Hope, West Virginia, and recently directed an oral history project in his hometown. He was speaking with Roxy Todd. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back. When Mount Hope High School integrated, the surrounding schools in southern West Virginia remained segregated. When the football team took the field, there was a unique kind of competition. Here's producer Michael Klein explaining how integration went for the football team in Mount Hope, West Virginia, on the field and in the community.
Lonnie Warwick, like Sam Pugh and others, looked at the black families in the Colt camps all around him as extended family, and was as comfortable sharing a meal at their home as he was inviting them to his own table. Through college play at the University of Tennessee and later as a national football hero with the Minnesota Vikings, he became an activist for racial harmony in the NFL. It began with his mother's invitations to all his Mount Hope teammates to join in pregame meals.
Before the game that night, they'd walk up a street to my house in Kilsyth. My mom had dinner ready. She had enough for Lorenzo Ross, Howard Griffin, Johnny Mayo. Come on in here. We'll sit right down here, boys. And your mom would feed them. Or if they had a ride to go to Glen Jean, you'd get in the car with them and go to their house and eat and stay with them until game time to come back. That's the way it was. After you get through eating, let's get out here on the porch. Got a place to lay down. Rest up for the night. Got to be ready for Oak Hill. Woodrow Wilson or Beckley, you got to beat them.
We are the Mustangs, the mighty, mighty Mustangs. Everywhere we go, people want to know who we are. So we tell them.
Jack Spadaro's father, also Jack Spadaro, maintained the locker room facilities where the team dressed. He was far more than a mere janitor, however.
When we came to that gym, Jack was our father, and he treated us with respect.
Charles McKinney.
When we did wrong, he chastised us. When we did right, he praised us. So sports opened up my mind and made me the type of athlete that I was.
Baby Charles was a great athlete.
I was kind of big. I weighed about 160 pounds in junior high school, so they put me on the line. I played line, and I played linebacker. I could outrun everybody on the football team. But what happened was we played Hinton, and I think this guy had about a 30-yard start, and I caught him before he scored a touchdown. And the next day I went to practice, the coach told me, "Say, no, I don't want you to be a lineman. You're going to be a halfback." And that's how I got to move up to halfback. And I was good. I played halfback and I played linebacker. Football team, we kind of like stayed together because it was a purpose. And the purpose was to become winners because, see, I thought that I had to be different. I had to be better, you know, so that I could get some recognition. And by winning and playing on the football team, it made that way.
Sam Pugh.
A lot of times we would go away on a football game or something like that, and we were criticized. They said we were, you know, all these blacks and stuff like that. We just laughed about it. We thought it was funny because we got along and just had a rip-roaring good time, and we always had a good team. Mount Hope was a well-noted football school, and we whipped a lot of rear ends across the state.
Dennis Keffer.
We went to Ripley and played Ripley High School when we were seniors. We knew that whoever won that game would be in the state championship.
Sam Pugh.
The crowd, they about beat the crap out of all of us with bats and, oh, it was terrible because of who we were. The Mount Hope Mustangs, we had black kids and white kids. They were all white. They didn't like us. And the parents, I mean, when we run out on the field, it was, we had never experienced anything like that.
And they scored first. They kicked the field goal in the first half. It was 3-0.
Dennis Keffer.
And in the second half, they lined up on some kind of defense. I was the center. And when they were spread real wide in front of me like that, the quarterback would call Keffer, and they knew it was going right up the middle behind me. And that happened, and Baby Charles got the ball. And
as I was running the 60-yard touchdown, I looked on the side. And it was a white guy running along up on his side here, like hollering, "Catch that nigga! Catch that nigga!" And he didn't realize what he was doing was making me go fast, because I was scared. The more he said that, the faster I went. Wasn't nobody gonna catch me.
And I can attest to it because I was running right beside him and behind him up through there because there was nobody to block. I was just running with him. Charlie told me he was actually afraid up there.
Sam Pugh.
Coming off the field was the same thing. But they said, "Leave your uniforms on, get on the bus, get out of there." And that's what we did. We got on Greyhound and headed south, still had the uniforms and everything on. And I don't know what we left up there, but it didn't mean nothing because we weren't going back to get it. But that's the way most schools felt about little old Mount Hope.
Linda Pugh.
I know how we were treated when we went to play sports by other schools. It wasn't me personally, it was more against the boys, you know, the name calling and rock throwing at the buses and things like that.
Gee, Marie, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. They were serious. They hurt people. And then we beat them by 3 points. Oh, gosh. That's why they said, get on the bus, leave your helmets, uniforms on, and get out of here.
That was scary to have the rocks being thrown at the bus, you know, hoping that you're not going to get hit, you know, at the window.
Sandra Williams.
I took it to be that they were throwing rocks because they didn't like the team, because we were winners. It could be that they were upset because we had a integrated cheerleading team as well as football team.
Black and white, mighty Mustang. If a white one don't get you, then a black one will. The spirit of the Mustang's with us still.
When I came to the football field with Jack and Jerry and all the guys, we all were the same.
Charles McKinney.
And we took that same camaraderie, and wherever we went together, we were always one. You know, and that stuck with me.
We became a tribe.
Jack Spadaro.
When we had football games, we had to walk a mile from the gymnasium where we put our clothes on to the football field, which is like an old castle. I don't know whether you've seen it or not, but it looks like a castle and surrounded by these stone walls. So we would start at the gymnasium with these chants led by Charles McKinney.
And we would march from the gym to the football field. And we chanted all the way. We had chants. What do you say? And they would say, all the way. We are the Mustangs, the mighty, mighty Mustangs. Everywhere we go, people want to know who we are. So we tell them, we are the Mustang, mighty, mighty Mustang.
And it would get into a kind of frenzy almost. You know, it was kind of fearsome for the other teams to hear.
And we were marching in turn, you know, with those cleats walking on the pavement. Man, it sounded like it was a herd of wild animals.
I was captain, along with Charles McKinney. And I came from a long line of football players. I think I had four uncles who were football players, and then my father, who all came to every game that I played. And if I made a mistake, they told me about it the next morning. It was part of it.
Brenda Troitino.
Mount Hope had a history of producing running backs. It just happened.
Lonnie Warwick.
You know, my senior year, we played 6 AAA schools. We were AA. And we beat all 6 AAA schools that year.
Sam Pugh.
A lot of them would say, oh, it's because they have the black. It was one of the first times, I guess, that any of the schools really, we showed the ability to be black and white that worked together.
Lonnie Warwick.
We beat Woodrow, Oak Hill. Man, we beat Bluefield. We beat all of them. We were a good team. Had good players, you know, had real good players.
Sam Pugh.
We knew our skin was a different color, but we were still like brothers.
Mickey Plumley.
The concepts of how you live your life, as taught by Gene Spadaro and other coaches that I've had, are just tremendous.
Brenda Troitino.
Gene Spadaro, who is a legendary track coach in the state of West Virginia, he was coach of the year a number of years ago. He has taught all of these young men, whether he was their track coach or their football coach or their basketball coach, he taught them more than the sport. He taught them life lessons, how you work together to achieve what you want in life.
Mickey Plumley.
One of the things he used to say was, Plumley, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
you conceive something in your mind, and then you put a plan into action to make that come true. So the plan that I put in action was rededicate myself to high school football, find a way to get a college scholarship, which I was fortunate enough to do. I had a full scholarship offer from West Virginia University.
I think it's the working together.
Brenda Torrentino.
There's that old saying, there is no I in team, and that's always been the way it was here. Everybody worked together. Each player knew what his job was. They were fabulous athletes, all of them, every one of them, black and white together. And they had one thing on their mind, winning that football game. And that's what they did. They worked together as a team. Each of them had their strengths, and they pulled together, and they made this town very proud because we had a lot of championship teams.
Think about the Mustangs, you'll find out they can move that ball without a doubt. Like a pack of wild animals on the field and a defense team that will not yield. Look at that ball, mighty Mustang. The action on the field used to give us all a thrill. The spirit of the Mustangs with us still.
Now Jack played defensive end. I played right behind Jack. Jack's responsibility was not to let the halfback get on his outside. His job was to turn him into me. And once he turned him into me, it was my responsibility to make that tackle. And Jack, as you notice, Jack was small, but he had the heart of a lion. And I liked playing behind Jack. And that's what got me and Jack closer together. And see, this is what sports do. It lets you know, you do your job, I'm going to do my job. And that brings camaraderie. It brings togetherness like that.
So we talk about that. Now, when we have reunions, we have a town reunion every year, and Charles McKinney and others who are on the team and I get together, and we talk about race, and we talk about what happened and how it was overall pretty good.
Charles McKinney.
We looked up to all of the athletes that paved the way for us. Otha Payne, John Mayo, Ted Spadario, Ron Taylor, Sylvester Nyland. We felt like that when they left as winners, it was our responsibility to take that baton, to take that football, and carry it on. And we did that. There was no ifs, ands, and buts about it. Winning has no color. It takes a team, and we were all black and white, and we knew what we were supposed to do, and we performed it. And we loved one another. When I say love, we love one another. And if any one of us would get in any type of trouble, I believe in my heart that we had one another's back.
We've been listening to an excerpt of a radio documentary called Game Changer, Football as a Catalyst for Peaceful School Integration, which was produced by Michael and Carrie Klein and Jack Spadero. You can hear their full story on our website, wvpublic.org. The voices in today's show were all recorded as part of an oral history project. As we heard, Jack Spadero grew up in Mount Hope, West Virginia, and recognized the value of sharing the stories of his hometown. What advice does Jack have for people who want to do an oral history project in their community? You know, maybe sit down to record their neighbors or their grandparents?
I think the thing to do is to let it shape itself. Don't try to direct it. See what happens when people can really say what they feel and what they remember, and you'll get the essence of those people and the essence of the story. I think that's the best way to say it. And, you know, a good example, of course, is the Foxfire program that began 50 years ago as an oral history, and it still continues. And it unearthed some beautiful tales of life in the mountains of Appalachia. And this story that we've unearthed, I think, can resonate for a long, long time. These recordings will be archived at the Culture and History Department, They'll be archived at some universities in West Virginia and will be used, I hope, many years from now to talk about race and tolerance and understanding, because we have plenty of documentation about the hate. I want to document something else and make it something that all of us can look toward to make this country a better place. You know, we have 500 years of oppression of black people to overcome in this country, and I can't believe that we're still having to deal with that kind of hatred at this time. And I want to do something to counter that. Okay.
That was Jack Spadaro, who grew up in Mount Hope, West Virginia. It is shocking and disappointing to me that we're still dealing with some of these same racial tensions so many years after desegregation. The story of the football player who insisted that the cheerleading team accept an African-American cheerleader just seems to show that it matters what kind of heart a person in power has. The black football player could have looked the other way. After all, he just got the right to join the team himself and could have left it that way. No, he wasn't in control of the entire school or even the team, but he had some authority and leverage in his position on the team and used it to demand better. The people who are in power, the people who have the respect and authority, must insist on equality and stand up for justice. But when they don't, I hope people recognize the leverage they do have. On this show, I'm passionate about sharing Appalachian stories. I believe in doing my part to work for a better tomorrow in Appalachia. We'd like to hear your stories about racial integration from your hometown. Send us your story to 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301, or you can email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Michael and Carrie Klein of Talking Across the Lines and the Mountain of Hope organization of Mount Hope, with support from the West Virginia Humanities Council. Music in this episode is by Dinosaur Burps, Jake Sheps, Kaya Cater, Dan Frechette, and Laurel Thompson. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer this week is Xander Alloy. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. And if you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.